of this show in the last two episodes to cover the rise and subsequent fall of the Carolingian Empire. But today, I want to cover a fair amount of ground. This is not to say that there isn't going to be a lot going on here, but the status quo of Switzerland will remain about the same until Otto I, which is about 80 years away. So I'm going to give a quick rundown of all the major events that happened specifically covering Switzerland, and then we will slow down to cover Otto's monumental reign. Names and events will come pretty fast, but most of it is not of great consequence. So, by this point, Switzerland lays right on top of the line dividing Charles the Bald's West Francia from Louis the German's East. The exact line between the two caused mainly political problems for now, but in the future, this line is almost exactly the point between the French-speaking Swiss and the German-speaking Swiss. Welcome to the History of Little Europe, Episode 1.7, Otto and the Magyars. Last episode, we left off with the final partition of the Carolingian Empire and the conquest of the Middle Kingdom by Louis the German and Charles the Bald. Now, we slowed down the pace, but returning to Louis the German, it appears that he made the same mistake his father once made, because the latter half of his reign is characterized by his sons rising up in rebellion. Eventually, the three would partition his kingdom into three parts as well, with Charles the Fat receiving Raetia and Swabia, which is the area roughly corresponding with East Switzerland and Southwest Germany. Meanwhile, Western Switzerland was officially incorporated into the territory of the Kingdom of Burgundy. This was originally a kingdom inherited by one of Lothar's sons, but through a very messy bit of politics, it eventually ends up being ruled by a Frankish noble loyal to Charles the Fat, that son of Louis the German, who inherited eastern Switzerland. So now, Burgundy is kind of an autonomous region, either ruled or influenced by East or West Francia, but never conquered. Charles the Fat would lead a very lucky life, as mostly by coincidence, many of the kingdoms bordering his would have their monarchs die, leaving him to inherit the territory. This first happened with Italy, then with the rest of the German lands, and he even managed to somehow luck into inheriting the entire western half of the Frankish kingdom. For a brief second, it looked like he had stumbled into reunifying the empire, and the Pope rushed to coronate him as the emperor. But alas, it was not to be. He managed to bungle up a Viking invasion, and ended up having to pay heavy tribute, which led to both Burgundy and West Francia to revolt. Both would succeed and win their independence from him. This separation would be formalized when his inheritance left each of the four kingdoms, Italy, Burgundy, and East and West Francia, to different successors. East Francia was left to his son Arnulf, who proved to be slightly more competent, though fighting, to annex territory in the Benelux region into Eastern Francia, but spent the remainder of his reign getting bogged down in a political fight in Italy. In the end, he did manage to win the title of King of Italy, but it was split off from East Francia in his son's inheritance. He was succeeded by Louis the Child, who, as the name implies, was very young. He inherited the throne at 7 and died at age 18. His reign was defined almost singularly by the Magyars, a nomadic horde which ravaged parts of the empire. Much less lucky. He managed to capitalize on instability in Western Francia caused by Viking raids and political And for those of you who don't know, Magyar is the word Hungarians use to call themselves. He was succeeded by Conrad I, who was believed to be Arnulf's son, but who there is also reason to believe was a bastard, making him the first non-Carolingian to rule East Francia. And since I am legally required to, I should mention that at this exact moment, the rulers of West Francia are making a deal with some Viking raiders to give them a kingdom of their own in Normandy. This kingdom would eventually produce William the Conqueror, and by extension, the Kingdom of England. So that's pretty neat. Conrad managed to seamlessly continue the practices of his successor by spending the entire time fighting and failing to fend off the Magyars. He would die just 7 years after being crowned. Conrad would be succeeded by Henry the Fowler, who went that one step further and let the Magyars pillage Switzerland, where they destroyed Basel and St. Gallen, which are today the third and eighth biggest cities in Switzerland. Having lost all authority over the region, a group of West Francian nobles marched in and claimed the territory for themselves. Henry spent the remainder of his reign fending off Slavs and Danes, until he capped off his reign with probably his only good action, naming Otto I as his successor, his only successor, and his complete successor. So I know that was a lot of names, but don't worry about it too much. Right now, what we have is a mildly independent Burgundy, a very troubled East Switzerland, Magyars running amok, and Otto I on the throne. Some of you may have also noticed that I stopped talking about Burgundy or Western Switzerland during that. This is for two reasons. One, it's an even more complicated mess of claimants, nobles, kings, and usurpers. But two, Western Switzerland is going to be waving goodbye to the show for a little while. Burgundy has popped back into the show briefly after being one of the three tribes of Switzerland, but it will not be incorporated into the Swiss Confederacy for a few centuries at this point. So we wave goodbye to it for now, and turn completely to the Germans. Otto I managed to be the first competent ruler of any part of the empire, perhaps since Charlemagne, more than a century and a half previously. In his reign, he will take the crumbling East Francia and transform it into what is now known as the Holy Roman Empire. And while the HRE has a reputation as also being a crumbling mess, for right now it will assert itself as the dominant force on the continent. In 936, at the age of 24, he became the king of the struggling East Francia, a position which he would hold for nearly 30 years before renaming it and ruling its successor. While he was not entirely Carolingian, and in fact descended entirely from Saxons, Otto would do his best to keep an appearance as a Frankish noble. The common people, both not really caring who their leader was, and being far more worried about the roaming hordes that kept pillaging their territory, rallied behind him. But the nobles, not believing this facade, and thinking of the incompetence of his predecessors, rose up in revolt. Otto proved to be his own man, though, and stopped the rebellion dead in its tracks. Indeed, he turned the whole thing into a net positive, as he pardoned the nobles responsible, and for the rest of his reign, enjoyed support from most of the aristocracy. It also risked inflaming the clergy, even the papacy, and usually provoked stronger defense. But Otto was playing for keeps, and he was playing to win. In the end, he won a smashing victory, killing all of the conspiratorial nobles and annexing Lorraine. The next decade or so is characterized by consolidation. He methodically replaced members of the nobility with people personally loyal to him, now using excellence rather than wealth as the deciding principle. And for even more security, he married or placed members of family into key positions. The understood hierarchy of loyalty at the time was family, then previously loyal and merited subordinates, then nobles, who generally benefited from your reign. This is, of course, a little ironic, as family, given the most trust, was almost always the people at the center of rebellions. This replacing of the established aristocracy did not pass without a fight, and several rebellions broke out. But they were always quickly subdued, and uniquely for this era, the responsible parties were almost never executed. His brother Henry rebelled twice, but even after that, he was let off the hook, and even managed to become Duke of Aquitaine. I say most of the nobility, because as it turns out, the nobles who rebelled against him were still angry. Some, still bearing resentment, went to the court of Louis IV of West Francia, and began stirring up some of Otto's family which had previously been exiled. Eventually, they convinced Louis to depose Otto and place his exiled brother Henry on the throne, which would have gone great had Otto not been exceedingly proficient in military matters. After gaining some initial success, Otto marched on Louis's capital at Laon, but was unable to take the city. In the end, it seemed like it would turn out to be a typical war of the period, where some minor concessions would be made and family dynamics resolved, but Otto did something strange for the era. He doubled down. He rejected peace terms and continued the campaign. Now, this was not something done often for a number of reasons. First and foremost, because most armies of the era were unable to support themselves over prolonged campaigns. He also managed to secure a loyal noble appointed to the Burgundian fold, making it aligned, though not officially part, of his growing empire. He even subjugated the Slavic tribes, extending his hegemony further east than even Charlemagne had managed. Otto then turned his sights south to a territory that had managed to stay out of the dynastic struggles of the past half century, Italy. During that time, a relatively peaceful series of kings held the throne, and due to their relative position to the Pope and Rome, they had managed to claim the title of Holy Roman Emperor for themselves. Of course, they had no control of any territory past the Alps, but it was still a coveted title, and Otto, clearly positioning himself to be that emperor of a united empire, began making moves to conquer Italy. During his decade of consolidation, he had managed to place a loyal noble on the Italian throne, but that was just to ensure stability. He launched an invasion in 951, in which he managed to seize the capital of Pavia, but was unable to consolidate control before issues with the Danes and eastern tribes forced him to cross back over the Alps. The king of Italy attempted to use the pressing issues elsewhere to his advantage, and proposed he continue to reign as client king, but once again, Otto chose to play to win, instead provoking another conflict, even with border issues elsewhere. Once again, he would come out the other side victorious, annexing territory and demanding a massive tribute. With that now settled, Otto resumed his consolidation of power, but this time, he was interrupted by domestic politics. His son, Liudolf, had grown discontent with his father over that time, especially after he had a second son, who he named Henry II. It seemed likely that with a title like that, his second son would be chosen as heir, so he decided to preempt that decision and revolt now. Otto was quick to defeat him on the open field, but with Hungarian and Slavic incursions on his eastern border, he made a generous peace deal. His son would be granted the title of King of Italy, even though there was already a King of Italy out there, and he would still be first in line to inherit his realms. With that now settled, Otto turned his attention to that Hungarian invasion. The Hungarians had more or less been guaranteed a free reign over the fringes of the Southern Empire, and some were even still running amok in Switzerland. Otto decided to change that. In the Battle of Lechfeld, 955, Otto, despite being outnumbered 2-1, managed to charge the front of the Hungarian army, which preferred hit-and-run tactics to close combat, and broke them. This defeat would mark the last Hungarian incursion into Western Europe, and while they retained control over their lands in the southwest of Otto's kingdom in modern Hungary, they lost control over Switzerland and influence over the border. The battle also had cemented Otto's rule, but in a different manner. His son-in-law Conrad had been killed, and his brother Henry, the same which had revolted twice, was mortally wounded. Liudolf then died a year later of a fever. This left Otto without any suitable heirs, but it also left him without any pretenders to the throne. Liudolf's death also had the side effect of removing the King of Italy, a position that Otto still wanted within his control. The previous King of Italy, thrown about by the whims of his northern neighbors, attempted to reclaim his title, but Otto quickly reconquered the territory. Having subjugated them a second time, Otto now took the title of King of Italy for himself, formally unifying the two kingdoms. He also took this time to play some papal politics. He traded his recognition of Pope John XII as the spiritual leader for his recognition of Otto as the secular leader, and for good measure, Otto ceded more Italian land to the Papal States. This was done not out of selflessness, but instead because the exact particulars of this trade with the Pope allowed him to name the Pope before the Pope named him Emperor. To Otto's mind, at least, this made the authority of the Pope still subservient to the authority of the Emperor, reclaiming a symbolic piece of power that Louis the Pious had sloppily given up in the last episode. And yeah, that means Otto is now the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, a kingdom now spanning from about halfway down the Italian peninsula, up across the Alps, through the eastern parts of Switzerland, part of Austria, all of Germany, as well as the Netherlands and part of Belgium. This empire would last for nearly 1,000 years, and even though during most of that time it was not a cohesive unit, but a mess of squabbling states, it dominated most of the European continent, and whenever unified proved to be a tremendous source of power. Speaking of that divided empire, Otto is the source of that factor as well. Seeing that the size of the empire was well beyond a single person to govern, he created a system of lower nobles that would directly control large territories within the empire, but still be subservient to the empire and provide a share of their troops and tax revenue. This way, the emperor could focus on the large picture issues, while small matters could be handled by local nobles. The problem arose, however, when these nobles turned around and did the same thing, but one layer down. They created a system of even more minor nobles and rulers within their own territory, who could act independently, but would still be subservient and provide an army and tax revenue. And just like that, most of the governing of the empire was suddenly divided among the hundreds of minor nobles, with tiny chunks of territory scattered all over the place. This system of power sharing worked fine for Otto and his direct successors, but as time went on, the emperor began to get less involved in their lower nobles, instead just enjoying the tax revenue from sitting on top, and only rallying everyone when some foreign threat loomed. And again, these lower nobles let their lower nobles do as they please, just enjoying the fruits of their position. But this is key to our story, because among those tiny states was a collection of cantons, high up in the Alps, who would begin to think that maybe the empire's upper nobles were not an effective or sufficient authority, and decided to form their own confederation. We are at last coming to some true Swiss history. This would slowly undermine the empire, turning it into more of a confederacy of hundreds of tiny independent kingdoms. Perhaps the greatest decision Otto made, though, was about succession. After 400 years of everyone dividing up their empire every time they died, and he recognized the stability and the opportunity the decade most spent on fraternal conflict had provided him. It also helped that he didn't have a good option of his own, and their heirs then spending years warring over their new territory, Otto realized there was probably a better way. It had helped that he himself had been chosen as a singular heir, so he decided to establish a new system of inheritance. First, only one heir would be chosen. Everyone else would have to be content with whatever duchy or territory they were otherwise controlling. But second, and something relatively unique in world history, that heir would be chosen by the electors, the leaders of various key territories throughout the empire. No longer a hereditary position, the hope was now that the position would go to the most capable and trusted man in the empire. In the end, it would more open the door for corruption, and dynasties would still develop, and the position was often automatically voted to the son of the previous emperor. But while the various members of the nobility were loyal and capable officials, it gave the empire a better chance at better successors. And given that this title was also Holy Roman Emperor, this means that the title, held by all the great Roman leaders, was now chosen by council. To my mind, only Nerva can be placed in the same category. In the end, these broad changes would be the last of Otto's long reign. Otto had helped remake the empire from top to bottom, and helped reunify a fracturing political system, and had filled the positions with men loyal and capable. That he ever did that could be considered a mistake. While the Carolingian dynasty was now wiped off the face of the earth, Otto I had established a new dynasty that would prove to be even more successful. In the end, after more than 30 years of reunifying Central Europe, he died in 973. When he did, a council of nobles would confirm his son, Otto II, as the new emperor, and for the first time ever in the long history of the Frankish successions, the transition of power was seamless. As always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, declarations, manifestos, or affidavits, feel free to send them at historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com. Stay tuned, be sure to subscribe, and give the show a 5-star rating. Until then, pozegnanie, ciao, and goodbye. While some of his decisions would be seen negatively later, there were very few things...